ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas, ACT Radio. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to non-human animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about why a plant-based diet is not only the best for the planet, but best for humans and animals as well.
So if you're concerned about the planet, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Kathy Stevens, the founder and director of the Catskill Animal Sanctuary. That's coming up a little later, but first some news.
From In Defense of Animals, in a shocking move, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or AZA, reportedly approved a request by the San Antonio Zoo to keep a 53-year-old female Asian elephant named Lucky in isolation. Lucky is now the only solitary female elephant in an AZA-accredited zoo in the U.S. The zoo's director told the media that Lucky will remain at the zoo until she dies. The zoo's other elephant, Queenie, died in March. No elephant should ever be held in solitary confinement. Female elephants are profoundly social. They live in matriarchal, multi-generational herds in the wild that include sisters, aunts, nieces, and nephews. The AZA's own guidelines require that elephants are housed in groups of three. Yet the AZA is inexplicably sanctioning the San Antonio Zoo's cruel decision to keep Lucky alone. This is the third variance the AZA has given to the zoo in a decade to house Lucky alone, despite pleas from the community to deny the unreasonable and inhumane requests, and instead send Lucky to a facility that can meet her physical and social needs. If you'd like to take action and help get Lucky retired to a facility with a more natural environment where she's free to roam and have the companionship of other elephants, please visit IDAUSA.org.
Deutsche Welle reports that India has officially recognized dolphins as non-human persons whose rights to life and liberty must be respected. Dolphin parks that were being built across the country will instead be shut down. India's Ministry of Environment and Forests has advised state governments to ban dolphinariums and other commercial entertainment that involves the capture and confinement of cetacean species such as orcas and bottlenose dolphins. In a statement, the government said research had clearly established that cetaceans are highly intelligent and sensitive, and that dolphins should be seen as non-human persons and, as such, should have their own specific rights. The move comes after weeks of protests against dolphin parks in the state of Kerala and several other marine entertainment facilities which were to be built this year. Animal welfare advocates welcomed the decision. A spokesperson from the Federation of Indian Animal Protection Organizations stated that this opens up a whole new discourse of ethics in animal protection movement in India and is leading the movement in India to end dolphin captivity. The movement to recognize whales and dolphins as individuals with self-awareness and a set of rights gained momentum 3 years ago in Helsinki, Finland, when scientists and ethicists drafted a Declaration of Rights for Cetaceans. They affirm that all cetaceans should be regarded as persons and have the right to life, liberty, and well-being. The signatories included leading marine scientist Lori Marino, who documented evidence that cetaceans have large, complex brains, especially in areas involved in communication and cognition. Her work has shown that dolphins have a level of self-awareness similar to that of human beings. Dolphins can recognize their own reflection, use tools, and understand abstract concepts. They develop unique signature whistles, allowing friends and family members to recognize them, similar to the way human beings use names. India is the fourth country in the world to ban the capture and import of cetaceans for the purposes of commercial entertainment, along with Costa Rica, Hungary, and Chile.
Iceland will resume illegal commercial whaling this month and had planned to kill up to 174 endangered fin whales and sell the meat to Tokyo-based Michinoku Farm, which was going to turn the whale meat into dog treats. Protests from environmental groups prompted the Japanese company to cancel its order, but the whale hunt is still on. Claire Perry of the Environmental Investigation Agency said, "It's outrageous. It's grotesque to kill an endangered species and then ship it halfway around the world in order to feed it to dogs." Meat from North Atlantic fin whales has been sold by Iceland to Japan for human consumption since 2008, but its use in pet food is something new. Japan appears to have moved into the pet food business because of a dramatic decline in consumption of all types of whale meat by people. Takuma Kono, head of Mishinoku, confirmed that the plan had been scrapped. He said, "Dogs are like family members for many people in Japan. We just wanted to supply a wide variety of food for them. We consider dogs just as important as whales. But it's not worth selling the product if it risks disturbing some people." "Really? You didn't think some people would find this idea disturbing?" The canceled order hasn't changed plans for whalers in Iceland, who, after a 3-year break, will resume hunting fin whales later this month. Stay with us. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with Kathy Stevens, founder and director of the Catskill Animal Sanctuary, and author of the book Animal Camp, Reflections on a Decade of Love, Hope, and Veganism at Catskill Animal Sanctuary. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Kathy Stevens. Thanks for being with us on the show, Kathy.
Greg, Liz, Tom, thanks for having me.
Can we start out by having you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got involved in animal issues?
Sure thing. I was a farm girl in Virginia. You might hear it in my accent. I grew up on a horse farm, a thoroughbred horse farm, and yet we always had a few cows, a couple of goats, just a farm full of animals. So I've always had almost a reverence for animals. I've always been surrounded by them, with the exception of sort of a decade in my professional life when I moved to Boston and New York City. But it was only when I had been offered a job as a principal of a new high school and turned it down that I started looking for ways to combine my love for animals with my love for teaching and learning. And that search led me to farm sanctuary. And I had never heard of sanctuaries. I'd been a vegetarian for health reasons. But going to Farm Sanctuary in 2000 and doing the internship there and seeing all the movies, the videos that everybody knows about, really helped me connect the dots, and it was very clear what I needed to do.
So you bought a dilapidated farm.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly. That's sort of the understatement of the century. It had been used illegally as a junkyard. It had been a farm some decades before. Also, interestingly, a standardbred horse farm breeding and training facility, but had fallen into disrepair, and then the business just shut down, and the owner let his friends use it as a junkyard.
So you've been in operation since 2001, is that right?
That's right. We've been in existence since 2001. We bought the farm in 2003, so the farm is a decade old.
Oh, okay. And how many animals are on the grounds at any one time?
You know, it's so hard to say, but I, you know, 200-ish, sometimes that number swells to 300 when we do a big rescue. If we have an unusual number of adoptions, it can go down to maybe 175. Mm-hmm. Right now, we've got maybe 220, roughly evenly split between the big guys, horses, cows, goats, sheep, farm pigs, and the smaller animals, and we have actually about 100 chickens.
In reading your book, Animal Camp, you mentioned a couple of times that you rescued some chickens that were at a crystal meth lab. What were the chickens doing there?
Well, you know, what the SPCA, this was out in Kansas City, and what the SPCA, who took the birds but then had no facility for them, told us is that the manure was being used to disguise the scent of the production of the crystal meth.
Wow.
So go figure.
That's pretty bizarre.
Yeah.
One thing that I was interested in is that it seems like you do get a lot of your animals from hoarding operations. Can you tell us a little bit about how that evolves?
Yes. You know, any sanctuary has limited resources, limited space, limited finances, limited human resources. So you have to take, you have to respect your limits and then take those where the need is the greatest. And hoarders aren't just crazy cat ladies, which is the perception. Hoarders frequently hoard farm animals. And I would say that over the, we've rescued over 2,500 animals now, and my bet would be that 3/4 of them have come from animal hoarders. And what they do with farm animals is, in the warmer months, they can sort of subsist on grass, and then in the colder months, they will literally very frequently just shut the barn doors and allow the animals to just succumb. They're very often many dead bodies on the properties of animal hoarders. It's a horrific problem because it's not something that an SPCA or law enforcement in any community is typically equipped to deal with, trained to deal with, has the inclination to deal with. So hoarding often, particularly of farm animals, often goes ignored. You know, there are 5 or 6 horrible hoarders right in our community who've been doing it for years, and they just continue and nothing gets done.
Well, where are they getting the animals from?
They go to auctions. Some very misguided people drop off their animals thinking that people are, you know, are going to help the animals. They allow breeding to go unchecked so that a lot of it is just their lack of responsibility. So, you know, there was a, we took some horses some years back from a woman who had, a few years earlier, had 10 horses, but by the time we went in, she had 70.
I think the, you know, the tragedy of the hoarders, too, is that they repeat. So even if you go in and take out the 60 or 70 animals, unless law enforcement or, you know, the judge in the particular case puts a stipulation that they can't own animals for a certain amount of time after that, odds are they're just going to fill right back up, and then, you know, you're there to deal with the problem again.
They are absolutely repeat offenders. It's epidemic in this country, and it's largely not recognized or addressed. It needs to be diagnosed as a mental illness. There needs to be some sort of legislation defining hoarding, and then talking about, you know, a maximum number of animals per acre or something. But it's a problem that's very, very poorly understood and very little, very poorly even recognized, both by law enforcement and by the public in general.
You mentioned in your book that the laws about animal cruelty were written before hoarding was even considered. And so they were thinking about torturous cruelty and not this hoarding thing. So it's very hard to make the law apply.
Yes, it is. And there's an interesting, one of the experts that I interviewed for the book on hoarding was talking about the frustration of the fact that you typically have to prove cruelty to every single animal on the property, and whereas there needs to be the ability to just look at the situation in toto and take sort of a snapshot and say, okay, this person is incapable of handling animals, so that all of the animals can be removed from the home or the farm.
Well, Kathy, you said that you think it's becoming an epidemic, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts of why this type of behavior might be increasing in America.
I don't know that it's a fact that it is increasing. It may have been epidemic for quite some time, and we're just more aware of it because we've been doing this for a little while now. But, you know, there are a lot of lonely people. There are a lot of sort of broken people who don't have family. That hoarders are typically very, very isolated people, and I think they're doing this compulsive behavior in part to get something from animals that they're not getting from human beings. Mm. The irony is the animals are suffering tremendously.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
In your book, Kathy, you know, it's a collection of essays and stories about individual animals. Who was your first resident at the sanctuary?
A tiny little Shetland pony named Dino, who was the only survivor of an arson. He kicked his door down in the barn in Brooklyn when 23 animals succumbed to the fire.
One of the most amazing things that I found from reading your book was how the animals make friendships across species. I hadn't really given a lot of consideration to that. Can you tell us some of the stories of the most unusual cases of friendship between species?
I sure can, and it happens all the time. And, you know, it's one of the arguments we make when we invite people to consider veganism, that if they, you know, the industry is so good at hiding these animals from us to the point, and, you know, with all their marketing and all their political power, we really don't see food animals in the same way at all that we understand our dogs and cats. But we've come to understand, and we even have it on a T-shirt, is that in the ways that truly matter, we are all the same.
Mm-hmm.
And this interspecies friendship is an example of this. It really, what we see over and over and over again, is that animals bond at least as much by temperament as opposed to by species. And we've had dozens and dozens of interspecies friendships. Some of the more notable ones have been between goats and turkeys and chickens, or sheep and turkeys and chickens. There's a chapter in the book that I actually wanted to name the book. I wanted to name the book The Audacity of Love, but the publisher said no. This it tells a story of a remarkable friendship between a broiler hen, and I know you've got an audience who knows what broilers are, a broiler hen and the most extraordinary animal I've ever known, a sheep named Rambo, and they were absolutely devoted to each other. To the point where when our Barbie was sick and had to be removed from the barn and then was reintroduced to the barn after several weeks, she walked through the flock of free-range hens, walked right through, didn't hesitate, and went all the way down the barn 50 more feet till she found Rambo and nestled right up next to him. The complication was that Rambo was also doted on by a sheep, who was insanely jealous of the chicken. And the reason I tell these stories, guys, as you know, because you've read the book, but, you know, this is the part that's missing for us. This is not just about feeling good. This is very serious work. We want to create vegans.
Right.
That's really the bottom line. And there are a lot of people out there talking about the health impacts, the devastating environmental impacts, and the urgency, how desperately the earth is pleading with us to go vegan, along with the suffering of the animals. Where I see the gap is that we're not talking about who the animals are. So sometimes we try to focus on that because I feel like a lot of times that's the information that's not readily available and that will help people begin or continue this really important journey to veganism.
And it's really important to draw upon the relationships that people have with their companion animals, cats, dogs, birds, etc., and try to educate them that farm animals are capable of these same kind of intense bonds.
Oh, my goodness. We have lap chickens and lap turkeys and goats who walk right into the office and all the rest of it. Yeah.
Well, it seems like it makes it easy for people, you know, when they think about the food chain, and then it makes it easy for them just to see one animal on top of the other. And the beauty of these stories, I think, is it really shows that it's much more complicated than that.
Absolutely.
So tell us a couple more of the stories that you highlight in your book, Animal Camp.
I know one I'd like to hear. the sheep, was it a sheep, Aries? That was very moving. The way he went around and said goodbye to all his friends?
Yeah, it just was, I do not know how he knew, but it was very clear that he knew that his passing was imminent, because he spent the morning, I mean, we were all in tears observing this, spent the morning. Now, this was an animal who had not gotten up. He was ancient, and he was severely arthritic, and he wasn't processing his food very well anymore, and it was clearly time to euthanize him for humane reasons. And, you know, a couple hours before the vet came, that animal, who had been pretty much immobile for a couple of days, got up and struggled around, and we watched him go from animal to animal to animal, and it seemed really clear to all of us that he was saying goodbye. And then, afterwards, what was even more remarkable, we left his body in the stall for a couple hours, as we often do, so that their friends had the opportunity to come and say goodbye. And when we came back to get him for burial, we looked, and many turkeys and chickens and another sheep were lying around him, surrounding his body.
That was one of the many moments I cried in your book. Fortunately, there's a lot of times I cried just for happiness.
Yes.
Like when a child on a tour meeting the animals suddenly says, well, that's it, I'm not eating meat anymore. That must be very touching to witness that happen, and it probably happens quite a bit.
It does happen quite a bit. I mean, I often feel like if only there were more sanctuaries, or if only more people visited sanctuaries, this whole challenge of creating vegans wouldn't be so difficult. We see it happen constantly. I mean, you know, we have the vegan cooking classes. We have lots of programs designed to encourage people who want to make that change but don't feel like they know how to cook, for instance. But we see it over and over and over on tours, like people just crying and saying they understand and saying they didn't realize or weren't yet willing to look at the information, weren't yet willing to let in the suffering. But when you've got a cow, you know, when you've got a 2,500-pound steer who could kill you, and you've got 3 and 4-year-olds draping themselves over that animal's back, and that all that animal is doing is, you know, licking the people who are surrounding him, that does something to people. And when you bend down and say hello, and a chicken comes up running just to say hello, that does something to people.
Or when you call out the name Franklin and the pig comes running.
And all the pigs do that. All the pigs know their names, and all the pigs come running to, or walking, depending on their age.
You know, it seems like you really have successfully combined teaching and animal issues. It seems like you're the principal of the Catskill High School, and your teaching staff all have feathers and fur.
I think they do. They're wonderful ambassadors. They're wonderful teachers. And these exciting programs that we love to offer. We've got a cooking class tonight where we're having a sit-down dinner for 12 people just to dispel the myths about vegan cooking, and then we're having a 4-course dinner. So the programs are here to supplement what the animals teach.
What other kind of programs do you have besides the vegan cooking?
We have a day camp for children called Camp Kindness. We'd like to eventually expand that to be an overnight camp so we can take kids from greater distance. And what's interesting about that is that this is its 4th year. Last year we realized what we needed to do was to have some version of a Camp Kindness for adults, because the parents come to us at the end of the session saying, I don't know what to cook because my child is not going to eat animals anymore. So that's the main other program. We also do a lot of speaking in and around schools and colleges in the region. And we brought on a wonderful new program director and are going to be looking to expand our programming for 2014.
And where can our listeners learn more about your sanctuary?
CASanctuary.org. The book is available on the website. It's also available on Amazon, and the website is CASanctuary.org.
That's a very easy one to remember, and we hope all our listeners will go there and learn how they can better connect with farm animals, because I think you're right. You know, just it's unfortunate that people have to have a unique experience to, you know, appreciate the connections that can be made, but it seems a lot of times to work that way. It turns out that individuals need the experience. Watching others have the experience doesn't always work.
No, it really doesn't, and look how removed we are from our food animals, our farm animals. We just don't. I mean, we're having the first vegetarian public school in the country is coming here for a visit on June 19th, and almost none of those children have ever met a farm animal.
Wow.
That's great. It's great work you guys are doing, Kathy.
Thanks, Liz, Tom, and Greg. This has been an absolute pleasure.
All right. We've been talking with Kathy Stevens, the founder and director of the Catskill Animal Sanctuary, and author of the book Animal Camp. Thanks for being with us on the show, Kathy, and we wish you continued success.
Thanks, guys. Keep on with your great work, too.
If you'd like to learn more about the Catskill Animal Sanctuary and perhaps support their important work, please go to casanctuary.org.
The 21st Annual Animal Law Conference will be held at Stanford Law School on October 25th through 27th. The Animal Law Conference gives attorneys, law students, professors, and activists from around the world a place to share ideas, knowledge, and practical skills about advancing the interests of animals through the legal system. You can see the full conference agenda and register at aldf.org.
As the temperatures soar into the hundreds, remember never to leave your pet in a car or other vehicle. And if you must leave them outside at home, be sure to provide plenty of shade and water.
If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please go to vsep.org, the Vegetarian Society of El Paso. And if you'd like to listen to some of our past shows, you will find them at ktep.org. Just click the listen button. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.
We've got to love one another, love. We've got to love one another. We've got to love one another. Lord have mercy. Help us to love one another, Lord. We've got to love one another, even when we got the blues. Know what you might be thinking? I've heard it all before, but I don't care what you say, I'm gonna tell you just once more. We got to love one another, Lord have mercy. We got to love one another now. We got to love one another, Lord. Help us to love.